Chapter 3. A metal snake moves effortlessly over hills, matching their undulations. Inside the head, the vagrant works the controls. Anger manifests in his gestures, making course corrections sharp. He looks over his shoulder often, but Delta of the Seven remains folded in the space behind them, a placid statue. Her sword is on the floor by the vagrant's side. It, too, has gone quiet again, its eye closed tight. Rila sniffles quietly in the seat next to his. As he works, she tries to get closer to him, but straps hold her tight, thwarting the effort. A hint of a storm crosses her features, and she begins to wail. The vagrant glances over, touching a finger to his lips. Rila copies him. Her stormy expression abates, and he goes back to managing the vehicle. Calmer now, she attends to the vagrant. She positions her left hand like his, her fingers hovering over imaginary buttons. With her right, she mimes holding the control stick. She straightens her back, raises her chin, and after another glance at his face, adds a frown. When the vagrant looks through the viewing screen, staring intently, she leans forward to do the same. When, briefly, he presses his fist to his forehead, the frustration is mirrored in miniature. The vagrant does not notice. Gradually, the hills flatten out, and the snake winds its way over flatlands and between trees planted in orderly rows, wide-spaced, with branches that only start high up, shade-making and unobtrusive. There is a scratching sound from behind the head of the snake. Instantly, the vagrant tenses. He releases the straps that hold him, then turns, one hand still on the controls, the other reaching down for Delta's sword. Rila's eyes light up with new knowledge. She presses the central buckle where the straps cross over her chest, but nothing happens. She presses it again, using two fingers, then again with her fist. With a soft click, the straps spring apart. The scratching sounds again. It is close, coming from the other side of the metal that separates the head section from the body of the snake. The vagrant raises Delta's sword, his eyes flicking between where Delta sits and the intruder's location. There is a click, then a soft exhalation of machinery, and the panel slides back to reveal Jem. He has mud on his face and in his hair, but appears untouched by sword or flame.
It's me. It's just me. I was out tending the goats when the knights came. By the time I got here, it was too late. I managed to climb in the back while they were all distracted with you.
The vagrant stares at him for a moment, then places Delta's sword back on the floor. Jem's face splits in a relieved smile.
Rila! You're alive! Thank...
He notices Delta, springs back against the wall. His voice is much softer when he speaks again.
Is that...
The vagrant nods. A moment later, Rila nods.
But you can't just take her. What are you thinking?
The vagrant shrugs. Rila shrugs.
What are we going to do?
The vagrant holds up a hand. Jem's face sours as Rila does the same. Before he can comment, however, something over the vagrant's shoulder on the other side of the viewing screen grabs his attention.
Look out!
The vagrant whirls back to the controls to see they're heading directly towards one of the great pillars. Proximity alerts rapidly ramp up in volume. Streams of numbers representing distance and time to impact appear on the view screen, flashing to show their urgency. He jerks the controls, throwing the snake to the right and everyone inside the cockpit to the left. Only Delta does not move, her serenity untouched. Jem is thrown into the opposite wall, Rila and the vagrant hurled from their seats. A musical array of flesh smacking against hard surfaces follows. While the humans recover, the metal snake continues to veer to the right until it catches sight of its own tail, making circles of muddy brown in the grass beneath its tracks. The vagrant hauls himself back onto his chair, one hand pressing against the new bump on his skull, the other taking the control stick, pointing the snake forward once more. Jem also gets up, going to where Rila curls on the floor.
"It's all right," he says, gathering her into his arms. "It's all right. Oh, you poor thing."
She begins to cry, and Jem holds her tighter.
"Are you hurt? Does it hurt anywhere?"
Rila blinks, looks over to where the vagrant is, then takes a deep breath. She squeezes her face, squishing the tear on her cheek and forcing down the other ones.
"Rila?" Jem asks. "Are you okay?"
She nods.
"Does it hurt anywhere?"
She shakes her head, and Jem moves her over to the empty chair. As he fixes Rila into place, he glances at the vagrant, mutters,
"She should have been strapped in."
The vagrant's mouth opens in protest, but he says nothing. The snake travels on, its eyes lighting the dark ahead. On the viewing screen, green lines fill in details for frail human eyes. The gradations in the landscape, the outline of trees, and, on the horizon, the line where the sea begins. Unlike the vast majority of the citizens of the Empire of the Winged Eye, no one in the cockpit is in possession of a working chip. The vagrant has never had one, neither has Rila. Jem does have one, but it is poorly made, a cheap replica of those in the Shining City. It malfunctioned years ago. Now it is a purposeless lump, a little bit of junk in his brain. Because of this, none of them hears the broadcast. Delta does. She does not need a chip to translate the sounds for her. She hears all, understands all. Her head tilts to one side. Her mouth opens.
"Obeisance."
Even speaking, there is resonance to her voice. It fills the cramped space, charging the air. The humans are rendered motionless by its beauty. Fluidly, Delta rises to her feet.
"I am here," she says. "Exactly here."
As if in answer, new lights flash on the viewing screen, and something ripples in the sky above, a ship dropping out of cloak. It matches the metal snake for speed, flying directly overhead. The vagrant points at Jem, then towards the gun turret on top of the snake.
"I'm not going up there! It's suicide!"
The vagrant points again. Rila joins him.
"I can't! I don't know how!"
The vagrant sighs, pushes the snake to go faster. The skyship has no trouble adjusting its pace. A warning flickers on the screen. There is an incoming object. Before the vagrant can react, there is a thunk of something attaching itself to the snake's roof. A patch as wide as an adult's palm distorts above their heads, turning red, then white, so bright that all but Delta are forced to turn away. When the light fades, a hole is left behind, just the right size for the sphere to drop through. It rolls a few inches until it is perfectly positioned in the center of the space, then lasers project from every point in its surface, making grids of green fall like nets over every object in the room, mapping and highlighting all at once. The vagrant abandons the snake's controls and picks up Delta's sword. The grid over his face fades from green to red. The ones over Jem and Rila do the same, though Delta's remains green, vibrant, safe. The vagrant raises Delta's sword as squares on the grid fill with colour, specific, marking in the locations of major organs. He tries to sing as he brings down the blade, but no sound comes from his mouth, and the sword does not wake. The blade makes a dull thud as it hits the sphere. The laser grids stutter, fizz, and return to life. At the control panel, new proximity warnings sound. Everyone ignores them. The vagrant hits the sphere again. Delta's sword wakes with a start. It tries to close its eye again, but the vagrant has other ideas. He hits the sphere, singing, and this time the sword reacts, the sound passing down the blade, shimmering as it parts the sphere neatly in two. Instantly, the grids die out. The vagrant stabs a finger in Jem's direction, then stabs it towards the controls.
"But I..."
Jem begins, but stops as soon as he meets the vagrant's eyes. He moves instead to hover by the controls, ineffectual, as the vagrant runs deeper into the snake's belly. The vagrant reaches a ladder and climbs up into the turret. The plasglass dome that normally covers it is nothing more than jagged shards around the base, the guns reduced to slaggy tubes. As the vagrant looks up and down the length of the snake, he sees plumes of smoke where the other weapons are. They have taken away the snake's teeth. Above him, the skyship descends, getting so close that the figures leaning out of hatches are easy to see as they prepare to jump. Taking a breath to sing, the vagrant checks on Delta's sword. As soon as it realizes what is about to happen, the sword squeezes its eye shut. He bangs it against the side of the turret until the eye opens again, then admonishes it with a finger. The eye in the crosspiece trembles, but doesn't close. Again, the vagrant takes breath, thrusting the sword straight up as he sings. Delta's sword sings with him, and the air burns blue around it, the force of the song travelling beyond the reach of the metal, surging up until it meets one of the light drives in the skyship's wing. There is a muffled explosion, followed by a whine as the engine gives out and the skyship falls sharply to the left, scattering its cargo of soldiers onto the ground below. The vagrant watches their brief fall and the individual bounces and tumbles as they land. The skyship only bounces once before grinding to a halt. Satisfied, he climbs back down. Jem is happy to relinquish the controls, moving to stand behind Reela's chair. The vagrant drops Delta's sword on the floor with a clatter, frowning at all of the new warning lights on the screen. The display on the screen is no longer augmented, forcing him to squint against the plasglass to try and penetrate the dark. With a shrug, he takes the control stick and pushes it as far forward as it can go. Delta continues to stare at the hole in the ceiling. She speaks so softly as to be barely audible.
"Obeisance, where have you gone?"
The eye in her sword gives her a guilty glance before closing. Delta's lips move one more time, soundlessly.
"Obeisance."
The Knight Commander stands on the edge of the cliff, soldiers and knights forming up behind, ready. Greyspot 3 spreads out below him, a ramshackle sprawl. He sees the metal walkway that leads down into the shelter of the rocks. He sees the buildings, noting again how many have been built without authorization and without reference to any guidelines. They will find more undesirables here. Those that operate outside of Imperial law, tainted souls, criminals, the enemy. His head shakes, disgusted, involuntary. He had not realized how bad things had become, though he is sure the lenses know, which means Obeisance knows. If the first dares to walk their lands, what other monstrosities might they find here? How has this been tolerated for so long? And foremost in his mind, why didn't she tell me? On the edge of Greyspot 3, he sees the docks, and beyond them, the Empire of the Winged Eyes Armada, gathering. Their presence forms a floating wall, cutting off escape by sea, just as he and his forces block the cliff paths, sealing the port. Shadows fall across him, and he looks up. Alpha's sky palace has arrived. It drifts over his head, a vast battle platform defying physics, defying explanation. He does not hear the huge light engine, its thrumming at a pitch beyond mortal ears, but he feels it, the short hairs prickling on his neck and arms. He exults at its majesty, another miracle, the likes of which has not been seen since Gamma's great exodus. Somewhere inside are Beta, Epsilon, Theta, and Eta of the Seven. With them is Obeisance. Delta is conspicuous by her absence. He has heard that she is attending to some other business inland, but Obeisance has been typically obscure on the matter. Alpha is already down on street level. As the Knight Commander and his troops march down the walkway, boots clanking in synchrony, he sees the Immortal moving from house to house. Seraph Knights struggle to keep up, forced to scurry to match Alpha's giant strides. By the time the Knight Commander has reached the base of the cliffs, he sees a number of people have been pulled from their homes, rounded up and pushed to their knees. He raises a hand, and all of his troops come to a fluid stop, their discipline impeccable. The Knight Commander feels a tiny morsel of relief. No mistake is permissible when the Seven are watching. A single Seraph Knight hurries over and salutes.
"Report."
The Knight points to the kneeling citizens.
"Alpha says these ones are to be spared."
The Knight Commander does a quick headcount, his chip confirming the details as he tries to ignore their calls for help, for reassurance, for any kind of recognition. There are 130 people here, less than 1% of Greyspot 3's population.
"I see."
"What should we do, sir?"
His voice quivers. The knight is young, barely more than a squire. He has never seen battle before, but then neither has the Knight Commander.
"What we always do when we receive orders, we follow them."
He turns his head slightly, speaking to officers further away via comms.
"Captains, have your troops form a perimeter around the port. Nothing and no one gets through. Understood?"
Within his helmet, a chorus of affirmation echoes. The knights form up with him, their lances charged, ready, their eyes on him, waiting for the order. Doubt flickers within the Knight Commander's chest. He wonders if they are really about to destroy an entire port.
"Is this some kind of test? Surely we must be able to save more than these few. Even the tainted can be purged."
Doubt turns to fear as Alpha's gaze falls upon him. If he does not act now and immediately, he will be judged and found wanting. Perhaps he already has been. The Knight Commander swallows in a dry throat. He gives the order. The knights level their lances. By now, the people of Greyspot 3 have realized what is coming. Those with weapons ready them. Those without take cover. Despite the lack of time or cohesion, a resistance forms quickly. Houses become bunkers, windows gunnery ports. Those without conventional firearms resort to throwing whatever comes to hand. It is a swift and spirited response. The knights' lances spew fire, a wave of destruction, setting buildings and people ablaze. The rebels return fire, less spirited than before. Back and forth it goes, three times, with the resistance fading more and more. And then Alpha sings. It is a long note, sharp, that seems to go on forever. A migraine starts behind the knight commander's eyes, the sudden pain throwing off his aim. The other knights struggle too, their sword points lowering, wilting, while further back, the soldiers stop firing altogether. In one of the houses, a half-breed begins to scream. She is not tainted badly, not on the surface, but behind her skin the blood vibrates, burning up. Similar cries join her from scattered locations, and through it all, Alpha sustains the note. The knight commander is not sure how much more he can take, and he is not the target of Alpha's song. The rebels have stopped firing now, hands too busy covering ears or staunching blood that flows from nostrils to handle weapons. Three streets away, on a roof, a lone woman stands. Her clothes are well-worn, faded, but something in her posture speaks of command. Though the sound buffets her just as much as the others, she finds the strength to stand. In her hand is a sling pistol. She points it at Alpha, putting his silver face in her sights, and fires. A single shot, flung at a giant. For a moment, all attention goes to it, soldiers and citizens alike forgetting their pain as they gape at the unlikely attack. The knight commander cannot believe what he is seeing. He has time to realize that the woman's aim is true, time to pose the question of what he would do if Alpha fell, but not time to answer it. Set into the winged crosspiece of Alpha's sword is an eye. It tracks the incoming projectile. The knight commander is not sure whether it is sword that moves arm or arm that moves sword, but one moment Alpha's blade is at his side, the next it is arcing up, swatting the shot from the sky. Alpha stops singing, and three eyes turn to the woman on the roof. As the immortal's sword swings in her direction, the knight commander sees her turn, jump down, trying to put the house between them. Alpha sings a second note, and for a moment it is too bright to see anything. The knight commander is forced to shield his face from a world turned searing blue. When he looks again, there is no house, no woman, no resistance. Just a pile of ashes smouldering in the breeze. Then Alpha is moving towards the next house, and the knight commander is shouting orders, mobilizing his forces. This time, when the soldiers and knights fire, the rebels have no answer. Hours pass as the metal snake continues to work its way towards the coast. Despite its size, the vehicle moves swiftly. Smoke trails at sharp angles from shattered turrets, and the caterpillar tracks make short work of the uneven terrain. Delta of the Seven blinks, returning from thoughts of the past. She has been staring at a tiny hole in the ceiling, waiting for obeisance to come. But obeisance has not come. Her brothers and sisters are expecting her return. Alpha will be displeased at the delay. The thought concerns Delta, for she has always tried to be in harmony with the others, prided herself on it. She realizes that no immediate aid is coming and that she should take action herself. But what action? More information is needed. In turn, she regards each of the people sharing the cockpit with her. The child, Rila, sleeps badly. Straps meant for an adult ride up under her chin, digging in. Her dreams are reflected in Delta's eyes. She is trapped in a house that burns, and visored faces stare at her through windows, blocking escape. Studying her essence, Delta sees little to cherish, and the proximity of the taint, however slight, is unpleasant. The smaller man, Jem, is looking at her. He is afraid. He is right to be. She sees his mind making its petty calculations, the network of small lies that permeate his being, and beneath them a heavy sense of bitterness and regret she cannot help but feel empathy for. But more than all of this, she sees that he is tainted, spoiled by years of infernal contact. The other man, the one that once bore Gamma's sword and has now dared to use hers, is not tainted. Though he is easy to read, a simple example of the species, she does not understand where he fits, like a spare part left in the box after construction is completed. There is a temptation to keep him around, just in case, but really there is no need for him. She lingers briefly on the freshness of the man's grief, how it threatens to overwhelm him, the tidal surge of it held back by adrenaline, fear, and the demands of the moment. Delta knows what is expected of her. She closes her eyes, imagines Alpha giving the order. So easy is it for her to picture her brother, it is as if he were there, demanding their destruction. Her hand opens as she turns to where her sword lies. It is next to the vagrant's chair, feigning sleep. It does not respond to her summons. She considers picking it up. Certainly none of the humans present could stop her, and yet she does not pick it up. Even as the outrage runs through her that it has not responded, she realizes she does not want it to. Delta has always carried weariness within her, and she has little spirit for fighting. She did not leave the sanctum to bloody her hands. She left it to investigate her sister, to understand why the last fragment of Gamma acts the way it does. She tells herself that these humans are not worthy of her wrath, tells herself that it is only a matter of time before the Empire comes to collect her, and so it is not worth the effort of leaving. She tells herself that she is choosing to wait because it suits her. And then, because it is habit, and because it is easier, she sits down and closes her eyes. Both suns are in the sky, casting lights sparkling across the sea. Water dominates the view now, from the unbroken line of the horizon to the waves smacking against the shore. Throughout the dawn and early morning, the metal snake continues its journey, tireless. Thinning smoke leaks from ravaged turrets, but despite the battering, it moves as fast as ever. Jem comes over to stand next to the vagrant's chair. He glances at Rila, asleep in the straps, and lowers his voice.
"We're making good time."
The vagrant doesn't register the words at first, his attention elsewhere, in the past, on things lost. Amber eyes focus again. He blinks away tears, nods.
"Do you think we can get to Vesper before they do?"
The vagrant shrugs, and Jem looks past him towards their destination. Up ahead is a port, but not the great northern sea base that Jem expects to see.
"I thought you'd be taking us to Skylanding."
He leans forward, squinting, trying to recognize a landmark.
"It's not Northwing either. Where are we?"
The vagrant points at the navcom, shrugs.
"You don't know?"
asks Jem, incredulous. The display is damaged, but he is able to make out enough detail to guess.
"It's taking us to Greyspot 3, isn't it? But Vesper will be going to Crucible. We should be heading to Skylanding. That's the most direct route."
The vagrant gestures back to where Delta sits and shakes his head. He imagines the kind of welcome they'd get from the Empire's forces at Skylanding or Northwing and reconsiders.
"All right, you have a point, but we can't take Rila to Greyspot 3. It's not safe. It's full of refugees and rejects from the Shining City. For sun's sake, I've even heard rumours that the First's nomads use it as a trading spot."
Rila stretches, yawning, and whatever Jem is about to say is bitten back. The vagrant pulls gently back on the control stick, and the metal snake eases to a stop. He rubs at his eyes, bloodshot, before resting his hands on the dashboard. There is a pause, long enough to take a breath, to sigh, and then he is pushing himself out of the chair. Jem goes to unstrap Rila, but finds she has already stood up, a big frown on her little face.
"What's wrong?"
Rila looks up at him, solemn, but says nothing. The vagrant collects Delta's sword from the floor and opens the hatch. There is a hiss, and fresh air wafts into the stuffy room, enlivening. Jem moves to his side, pulling Rila behind him. He leans in close.
"What about her?"
Both men look at Delta for a moment. If she is aware of their scrutiny, she gives no sign.
"Maybe we should just leave her here."
The vagrant thinks for a moment, nods, and takes a step towards Delta.
"What are you... Actually, I don't want to know."
Jem retreats towards the exit hatch.
"Before you do anything, I'm going outside."
He looks down, adds hastily,
"To keep Rila safe."
The vagrant nods. Jem ushers Rila out, turning briefly before following her.
"Whatever you're going to do, be careful."
The vagrant raises an eyebrow. Alone, save for Delta, the vagrant seems to sag, the weight of recent events folding over his shoulders like a cloak. He pinches the bridge of his nose, knuckles tired eyes, and walks to where Delta sits. Carefully, quietly, he kneels down opposite her. The top of his head barely lines up with her shoulder. She does not stir. With reverence, he returns her sword, leaving it at her feet. He glances up, but her eyes remain closed. Neither sword nor immortal show any sign of having noticed each other. He stands slowly, leaves quickly, and doesn't look back. Outside, Jem and Rila are waiting. The three of them walk towards the cliff's edge. Up here they are exposed, the wind knocking at them, playful, tugging hair and making speech difficult. The smoke that rises from the other side is whisked away as soon as it peaks above ground level. The vagrant sees the smoke, and his frown burrows deeper.
"I don't like this," murmurs Jem.
They move nearer to the edge, battling the wind for balance. Jem holds one of Rila's hands, the vagrant holds the other. Slowly, by inches, Grey Spot 3 comes into view. Houses smoulder below, growing red, a scattered cluster of dying stars. Jem pulls out his old, battered scope. He sees details he could have done without. A high heap of bodies, stacked, blackened limbs rigid. Shattered buildings and bomb-scarred streets. The vagrant takes the scope, his jaw clenching as he takes in the details. Rila's scope is imaginary, but the grim set to her face is convincing nonetheless.
"Oh no," says Jem, tapping the vagrant's shoulder.
He looks over, and Jem points back to the metal snake.
"Look!"
Delta of the Seven stands between them and the vehicle. She is watching them, her expression unreadable. One of her silvered hands rests on the hilt of her sword.
"What do we do now?"
asks Jem. The vagrant looks over the edge of the cliff. The walkway that leads down the rock face is mostly intact. He runs for the nearest platform, pulling Rila behind him, pulling Jem behind her.
"But,"
Jem protests.
We can't go down there!
The vagrant ignores him, and when Jem gives a second look over his shoulder, he sees that Delta has started to follow them, and his protests die. Rusted walkways clank with every step. The top layer has disguised the damage further down. The side of the cliff has chunks blown out of it, and there is blood caked in the lattice of metal either side of them. There are no bodies here, however. Each has already been taken, fuel for the pyres in the port below. As they pass the worst of the damage, the walkway leans out, alarming. Four of the main supports have broken free of their housing, leaving power cables to hold up the structure. The vagrant stops. Reela stops.
Go on,
urges Jem. The vagrant looks down, very quickly looks up again, leaning back against the rock.
You know what they say. You should never look down. Wait! Don't you look, Reela! I said don't look!
The girl begins to overbalance, sliding towards the side. Tugging on an arm each, the two men pull her back. There is a long creaking sound as the cables adjust to the shifting weight. They all freeze until it settles, clinging to the wall, to each other. Jem is the first to move, pushing the others into action. They work their way down, zigzagging back and forth along the rock face. About three-quarters of the way, a cable twangs loose. There is a lurch, brief and fast, then the remaining cables catch. As the three of them ease their way along, the lean of the walkway becomes more pronounced, slowly succumbing to gravity. Like a drunkard falling over, it takes its time.
Run!
Shouts Jem. And they do. The vagrant scoops Reela into his arms, head low as he accelerates, Jem at his heels. Their feet hammer fast, raindrops on a rooftop, echoing loud all around them. Only two levels up now, the vagrant's feet start to slip, unable to cope with the acute angle of the floor. He leans back, trying to keep from falling over. Jem, unable to stop, unable to get past the slower man, shouts,
"Come on!"
Rock groans, final cables come loose. The entire walkway falls away from the cliff, belly-flopping into dirty sand and stone. The three inside it slam together against the mesh wall, then bounce to fall again, a tangled heap of arms and legs. For a while, all is still. Reela sits up, her younger body managing the impact better than the adults. She holds up a hand and inspects it. The crisscross imprint of the walkway runs up her palm and the outside of her little finger. There is blood where a nail has been torn. At the sight of it, she starts to shake. A bottom lip falls from formation, trembles. Jem springs up, suddenly alert. He presses his face against the mesh, trying to see through it, then turns back to the others.
Is everyone all right?
With a sigh, the vagrant levers himself up onto one elbow. Reela shows them her hand with a look of infinite woe.
Ouch, says Jem. That looks painful.
He goes back to the mesh.
I think we're safe. I can't see anyone else nearby.
The vagrant looks at her hand and, with a flourish, produces his own. Amid the calluses are new bruises, a bleeding knuckle, and a thumb twice as big as its counterpart. Reela nods, impressed. She takes a deep breath, and her lip settles again. Climbing out of the wreckage of the walkway, they see Grey Spot 3 from ground level. Aerial bombardment has destroyed any sense of landscaping the place might have had. Craters have given buildings new shapes, added ugly valleys. Lumps of churned earth make new hills, some of them still burn, slowly melting into puddles of slag. It is a dead place, but not everyone here is dead. Survivors sit and stand, united in shock, blending with the debris. They barely notice the newcomers, barely even notice their surroundings. Jem does. He picks up on glints in the rubble, moving from one to the other, searching for treasures amidst the chaos. He finds a few coins, one of them platinum, precious, and a bonding gun with half a cartridge still intact. While he does this, the vagrant looks back up to the top of the cliff. Sun's light glints off a silver figure as she steps off the edge. Wings open, dazzling, turning a fall into a dive, then a glide as she swoops low over the ground, heading straight towards them. The sight of her returns the survivors to life. As one, they scream, scattering in all directions. Jem, Reela, and the vagrant run too, but do not get far before her shadows rush overhead. The three come to a stop as Delta lands in front of them. She looks from left to right, her eyes bleak as she surveys the wreckage before coming to rest on a nearby corpse pile. Jem starts to edge away, but the vagrant takes his arm, gripping tight. He drops slowly to one knee, pulling the other two with him. Delta pulls out a body from the pile. The arms are asymmetrical, one thicker and longer than the other. She pulls out a skull, ordinary, small, and raises it in the palm of her hand.
How has it come to this?
The question is rhetorical, but the vagrant stands, drawing her gaze. He points out to sea, and when she looks, she sees a set of receding specks riding distant waves, a fleet bearing the symbol of the winged eye. Above them, ponderous, floats Alpha's sky palace. Delta closes her eyes. 1,051 years ago. Masasi makes the final adjustments to the metal by hand. Somehow this feels appropriate, as this is to be the most personal of her creations. The work is a slow race. It does not matter if she finishes today or tomorrow, in a year or 3 years. The breach is quiet, and her empire is stable. The threat here is internal rather than external. Masasi is racing her own degeneration. For some, this would lead to depression or collapse, but for Masasi, it is a spur. There is a clearly defined challenge and a theory on how to meet it. She'll be damned if something irrelevant like her physical body is going to get in the way. The main shell that she works on has already been shaped by powerful machines, the form of a man cast in metal. She knows people respond instinctively to height, and so she has made him taller than any normal human, imposing, authoritative, the kind of shape that demands obedience. Broad shoulders are added, and the suggestion of curves, muscular. Such things are unnecessary and bear no relation to her creation's actual ability, but she is making a symbol as much as a tool, one that should inspire confidence. She works long hours, finding hidden reserves of energy now that she has removed herself from the demands of politics and rulership. As she hammers and smooths, a face begins to take shape beneath her tools. A strong face, proud, regal. It is only when she is finished that she sees the amalgam of her past in there. Features of her supervisor blend with Insa's, which in turn blend with the Neuromaster she met decades ago, and with the first man sent to kill her when she was still a child. A disparate group to draw upon, but all were confident in their abilities, many of them opposing her, and all were bent to her will. Standing back to look at the shell, she cannot escape the sense that something is missing. It is not enough that the chosen form be large, impressive. She needs it to be bigger than humanity, something to stand above, to provoke wonder. Then it comes to her. wings. She will give her creation wings. She intends to instill many qualities and gifts, practical, important. Why not add something for fun? A rare smile finds its way to her face as she begins the modifications. One change soon leads to another, a whole set of new challenges presenting themselves. The need for aerodynamics and the practicalities of functional wings on a humanoid shape. Good, she thinks. Her life has been one long series of challenges. Why change things now? Time passes in a blur of thinking, designing, working and sweating, cursing and smiling. As the shell nears completion, Masasi starts work on its weapon. She has made swords before for her seraph knights. Each carries a tiny fraction of her essence, activated through song. She has kept them simple, limited in scope by the skill of the users. No such limits apply here. She intends to make something with its own consciousness. Part ally, part extension, a connected but separate entity. Metal is folded in on itself, again and again, the edge honed to cut, the blade tuned to focus and discharge essence. She gives the sword an eye, setting it into the winged crosspiece. Her idea is that the connection will run both ways, allowing the sword to inform its wielder of new developments on the battlefield and, if necessary, guide their arm in combat. The empty sword is placed in an empty hand, lifeless fingers curled around the hilt. When all is ready, she climbs onto the scaffolding and raises her metal arm. The iris in her palm opens, and she places her hand over her creation's eyes. Drawing deep, Masasi directs her will. Her aim is perfection, a being that will have no equal, that will have the power to do whatever is necessary. Essence surges from her, infusing the shell with light, with life. Some of this plays through its arm, flowing into the sword and back again. Like a child in the womb, the shell draws sustenance from Masasi, taking on aspects of her nature. She tries to hold back the regrets and the doubts, projecting only the strongest parts of herself. The essence within the shell takes shape, harnessed through lenses and cables, flowing like water through internal channels. It finds its own rhythm, becomes self-sustaining. Masasi releases her hold, falls hard against the scaffolding. All of the late nights, the long hours, catch up with her in a rush. Bones suddenly feel their age, and it is all she can do to wheeze, more human sack than godlike empress. As she exhales, the figure in front of her inhales, and the air crackles with energy. Three eyes open together, and Alpha is born. A silver hand reaches down, offering its support to Masasi. She has never accepted anyone's help before, but without hesitation she takes it, is lifted gently to her feet. For the first time, she is not alone. Looking up, she sees eyes of clearest blue, like the sky on a perfect flying day. They gaze at her in wonder, full of love. She checks Alpha for cracks, faults, and essence leaks, finds none. "You'll do," she says. Alpha's chest swells, picking up on buried praise. He speaks, and his words reverberate through the workshop, making metal chime and blood sing.
"I am ready, Creator. Shall we begin?"
"Oh, yes," she replies. "You'll do nicely."